King Arthur, yes, proof of our Hebrew roots. King Arthur, Camelot, and the Two Lost Kingdoms. King Arthur, who was he? Where did he come from? When did he live? Real or imaginary? Many, many books about King Arthur, several musicals, movies, some of them very good, some of them pure filth. There's even King Arthur Flower. And a historian, Norma Goodrich, writing about King Arthur, says certainly no other hero of the Dark Ages figures so preeminently in such a vast body of world literature as does King Arthur. They, speaking of the ancient historians, were every bit as interested in and as passionately involved in their endeavor to find the true King Arthur as we are in ours. And get this, and not a few of them devoted their lives to it, trying to figure out who is this guy. And you're going to find out within the hour. From this documentary, The Legend of King Arthur, never has there been a figure as magnetically attractive as that of King Arthur. Scratch beneath the surface of the legend and there are clues revealing a man, not a myth. Well, what was he known for? A man of valor, a warrior who later became a king, his knights, a round table, a sword, a stone, an adulterous woman, his spiritual advisor, etc. And the belief of many, he was a medieval king of England. And you ask him, well, hey, was he real or imaginary? I love to ask that question because they'll say, well, you know, I'm just not sure. Well, what is a legend or a myth? A legend is an unverifiable popular story handed down from earlier times, according to your dictionary. And I would ask, who handed it down and what were the earlier times? We'll look at that. Myth is defined as any real or fictional story, one of the fictions or half-truths forming part of the ideology of a society. So let's take an example. Let's say the number one represents a known fact. Number two, an embellishment. What is an embellishment? To add fanciful details to, i.e. I went fishing, caught a fish 6 inches long. But by the time I finish embellishing that fish, he's a foot long. True, I caught a fish, but size was embellished a little. So 1 + 2 = 3, i.e. a legend or a myth. Some fact, some fanciful fiction by the time it reaches a point. Example, the sword and the stone. Yes, I believe there truly was a sword and a stone involved in reality, but not the matter of who could pull a sword out of the stone was then going to become the king. And we'll look at that in a moment. So, who was King Arthur? Where did the legend come from? And what do most people say when asked these questions? But what do the professional historians say? The professionals are going to tell you that it probably was Celtic in origin. And that's where it arrived in England, by Celtic migrations. But in the year 2000, Scott Littleton and Linda Malcor, professors in California, come out with their book, From Scythia to Camelot, stating in so many words, wait a minute, we have found the true King Arthur, and the legend derived from Scythia. And that's how it came to England, Scythian migrations. And Scythians were made up of several tribes. We'll look at them in detail in a moment. And where was Scythia? In modern-day southern Russia or the Ukraine, north of the Mediterranean Sea, north of the Black Sea, and north of modern-day Israel. The Scythians, they lived there from about 700 B.C. till about 200 A.D. when the migrations took them farther west. They're mentioned also in Colossians chapter 3, verse 12 of your Bible, the Scythians. And there's a movie based upon that premise entitled King Arthur. And it purports to be based on true facts. Then Archaeology Magazine, May, June 2005, says, in fact, there's pretty good evidence for that fact, you know, and the Scythians going to England. But 2004, here comes Graham Anderson, a professor, with his book, King Arthur in Antiquity. He goes way back before the time of Christ and says that's when the legend arose. And who is Graham Anderson? Well, he's a professor of classics, University of Kent in Great Britain, not a dummy. You know, he's done his research. He knows his stuff. So he says that the legend came from Greece. And that's an interesting matter. And he says it was around 300 or 400 B.C. when the legend arose there. And that's how the legend came to England, you know, from the Greeks and the migrations and going on up from there. Well, who is correct? Could it be? They're all correct. Well, how is this possible? There's much debate about where the Celts came from, but John Francis Campbell, a prolific writer from Scotland in the 1800s, states what I believe to be the true location from where the Celts migrated. Why? Because he agrees with me and I agree with him. And he says they came from the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, which points us back to the shoreline of Syria, Lebanon, and Israel, eastern shores of the Mediterranean. Then there's interesting correspondence between a king Onias of Sparta, there in Greece, and Onias, the high priest back in Jerusalem, around 300 or 400 B.C., stating in so many words, we're kinfolk. Arius says, we both descended from Abraham. Now, as Steve Collins points out in his book, he doesn't say we're fellow Jews, but we're both descended from Abraham, leaving the possibility open that, hey, the Spartans, those in Sparta back at that time were part of the northern 10 tribes on their way to Europe. Then, in John 7, verses 35 and 36, there's an interesting comment where the Jews therefore said to one another, where does this man, speaking of Yahshua, intend to go, that we shall not find him? We cannot find him. He is not intending to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks, is he? So they evidently knew that there were some Israelites up there in Greece at that time, time of Christ, time of Messiah. Then here's the clincher. Anne Christensen, writing for the Royal Danish Academy of Sciences and Letters. Again, these folks know their business. You know, they do their research. In her book about entitled Who Were the Sumerians and Where Did They Come From? And by the way, there were several tribes, as I mentioned, of the Scythians, one of which was the Sumerians. Well, she concludes that the Sumerians were in fact identical with the Israelites deported from northern Israel after the fall of Samaria in 722 B.C. That's who they were. They're our forefathers there in Scythia on their migration west. So every source then, Celtic, Scythian, and Greek, points right back to where? To Israel on the eastern shores of the Mediterranean. Therefore, our triangle is complete. So, who is King Arthur? A man of valor, a warrior who later became a king, a table, a stone, a sword, a grail, or a cup, knights within his kingdom, adultery within the kingdom, a spiritual advisor, Merlin, 12 battles, one of which was a civil war. That's part of the King Arthur legend. A bear was involved in the King Arthur legend. A cart, King Arthur, according to the legend, made carts. And King Arthur was also a giant killer. So who is our King Arthur?
David
himself, King David. And there's Michelangelo's statue of David, very famous. Everybody wants to see the statue when they go over there. And Baracchio's David with Goliath's head at his feet. Yes, a man of valor, a warrior who took on Goliath when no others dared do so. A warrior who later became a king after the death of Saul. A king who had a table at which honored knights or his mighty men would sit. And that's discussed in 2 Samuel chapter 9. This is interesting. Out of the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, they're discussing David's mighty men, and they conclude these were the knights of David's round table. Now, they don't get to the point, hey, this King Arthur is actually King David, but they're kind of just beginning to see, hey, you know, something here looks familiar. And then Adam Clark's commentary, again, he doesn't make the connection either, but he's sure getting close. Regarding the life and character of David, he says, he had a company of champions, or as they were generally termed, worthies, or mighty men, of the number of 37. The account given of these, and it's in 2 Samuel 23, would almost render credible the legend of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. And it is probable that the first ideal of that ancient romance was taken from the genuine history of David and his 37 champions. I contend not only was it probable, it was. You know. So, a stone with which he brought down Goliath, and a sword with which he took from the fallen Goliath. Yeah, there was a sword and a stone, but it became embellished as to who could pull a sword out of the stone would then be qualified to be the king, you see. A giant killer, as part of the King Arthur legend, according to Graham Anderson in his book on page 135. Well, 1 Samuel 17, David was a giant killer. A cup or a grail, and David himself says, Yahweh is my cup, Psalms 16, verse 5, and my cup runneth over, Psalms 23, verse 5. A warrior who presented the head of the enemy to his king. Graham Anderson discusses that regarding King Arthur in the legend on page 130. Well, it just so happens that so when David, out of 1 Samuel 17, so when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. A man who is said to have single-handedly killed a large number of the enemy. Wikipedia discusses that regarding the legend of King Arthur. Well, 1 Samuel 18 and 19, Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. A man who spared an unyielding enemy was part of the Arthurian King Arthur legend. Well, King David had an unyielding enemy who stayed on his case from the get-go, his father-in-law. And you did not want a father-in-law like he had. Saul tried to kill him. Two times David could have killed him, but spared his enemy. First time when he when Saul was in the cave relieving himself, and David was encouraged to kill him by his troops, but he did not. And then later, when Saul was sleeping in the camp one night, David put a spear beside his head and took his water jug. Could have killed him. A spiritual advisor, Merlin. Now, you remember that in the legend, Merlin was an old man. He had long hair, and this weird stuff was associated with Merlin. Well, it just so happens that the prophet Samuel was an old man during the time of David. He had long hair because he was a Nazarite, and weird stuff when that witch of Endor calls him up out of the earth. So there's Merlin. A bear is part of the King Arthur legend. Well, David says, hey, I can take on this giant. I killed a bear and a lion while guarding my dad's sheep. An adulterous woman. Who was she? Bathsheba. Well, wait a minute, Roger. In the legend, it's the foreigner, Lancelot, making off with Guinevere, the king's wife. Whereas this is just the opposite. Well, yes, that's right. But hey, let's just embellish it a little bit because we can't have our hero being the villain. In reality, it was King David making off with Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite, the foreigner. More embellishment. King Arthur was the youngest son who took over the kingdom. Well, King David was the youngest son, number 8 out of 8. A king who had an errant son. In the legend, he's known as Mordred, but in reality, it was Absalom. a warrior who fought 12 battles, one of which was a civil war. It's part of the King Arthur legend. Well, I got my Bible, started counting them, 12 battles, one of which was a civil war. And I have that for you in handouts that you can look at. Blessed. The Taliesin poem, a man who was blessed, King Arthur. Well, it just so happens that King David says in 1 Chronicles 17:27, "And now it has pleased you," speaking of Yahweh, "to bless the house of your servant, that it may continue forever before you. For you, O Yahweh, have blessed, and it is blessed forever." Hallelujah. King Arthur was not morally impeccable in the legend. King David was not morally impeccable either. A king who made a cart. It's part of the King Arthur legend. Graham Anderson discusses it on pages 123 through 126 of his book. Well, King David had a cart made too to pull the ark. King David, that's not the way you do it, Bubba, and you got in trouble big time, and you resulted in the death of one of your helpers there. A knight who even in his later life was still having rebellion within the kingdom and fighting among his knights. That's King Arthur. Well, same thing with King David out of 2 Samuel 19. And then I love this one. King Arthur was known as a bard, B-A-R-D, or poet. The triad poem number 12. Graham Anderson discusses that on page 34. Well, a bard, you look up the root word in your dictionary, and it's going to be defined as one who praises. And who praises Yahweh more than anybody out of the Psalms? David, the real King Arthur. A king who will return. A king who will in the future return at rule and reign. Graham Anderson discusses it on page 129. "But they shall serve Yahweh their God, and David their king, whom I shall raise up." He's going to return for them. Jeremiah 30, verse 9. "And my servant David," out of Ezekiel 37, verse 24, in the two sticks, when we're restored, "my servant David will be king over them, and they will have one shepherd. And they'll walk in my ordinances and keep my statutes and observe them." And that's not happened yet, so it's on the horizon. King David's going to be restored, returned. Rex quondam et futuris. From this documentary.
But some said he did not die, and had gone to Avalon for the healing of his wounds. Others claimed he slept, waiting until his land had need of him. Then he would return. Rex quondam et futuris. The once and future king.
The once and future king. And there's even a book about that, at least one, and you see the sword on the cover stuck into the stone. What about Camelot? How does it fit into the legend? Well, out of this documentary, The Legend of King Arthur, here's an interesting statement regarding Camelot.
Someone once referred to the Camelot as being a representation of utopia, and when you actually look at what that means, it means nowhere at all.
Yes, you look up the definition of utopia, it means nowhere at all. Well, guess what? There are archaeologists over in England now trying to find Camelot. I'd read about that, and then I was interviewed once by a BBC reporter regarding a sexual abstinence or purity presentation that I give to kids. And so I asked her, "Hey, are archaeologists over there now trying to find Camelot in England?" "Yeah, they sure are." "Guess what? They're not going to find it." "You know why? It's not there." "Where is Camelot?" "It's Mount Zion, the New Jerusalem." Out of Psalm 48, verses 1 and 2, "Great is Yahweh and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in his holy mountain. beautiful in elevation. The joy of the whole earth. There's Camelot, and is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. And out of Psalm 84, verse 10, for a day in thy courts is better than 1,000 outside. I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. Camelot had walls of silver in the legend. Well, silver represents redemption. It's the Hebrew word kasef, Strong's 3701, and it comes from a root word meaning to become pale or pine after. And that pictures salvation, because what color would the skin of our Savior grow when he's hanging on the cross and all the blood draining out? Pale. And then pine after. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I've longed to gather you. Picture of salvation. And David accumulated 7,000 talents. That's 8.4 million ounces or 524,000 pounds of refined silver to overlay the walls of the buildings of the temple, according to 1 Chronicles 29, verses 3 and 4. And out of Isaiah 60, verse 18, but you shall call your walls salvation and your gates praise. This came from a prisoner, Roger Jackson, who viewed a DVD that I'd sent to him on this. And he writes back, if the Holy Grail is not an actual, tangible, physical cup, you know, like the knights in the legend were going to try to find, but a spiritual concept, and he cites verses out of Psalms and Matthew, then would we not find the Grail at every communion service or Passover Seder? Would not the cup that holds the symbolic blood of Yahshua be that Holy Grail, Holy Chalice? Thus, we can all find the Holy Grail, and we're all wanting to in one way or another. If we can just find Yahshua, we found it, you know. But he says we're all trying to find the Holy Grail, every one of us. And we can if we look for it in the right place, at the communion of bread and wine. Much as you say that we cannot find Camelot, it's because we're looking in the wrong place. It is, in fact, the city of David. Graham Anderson, in his book, says there's something about a stellar or star connection regarding King Arthur. He discusses it some, but he doesn't really get to the point, I don't think, as to. But there is a stellar connection regarding King David, too, because we read out of Psalm 89, verse 37. It, speaking of David's throne, shall be established forever. And then here's this interesting statement. And the witness in the sky is faithful. What in the world is that about? The witness in the sky is faithful. And as we explore this question, let's also think about, was one of David's mighty men a black man? Let's think about that. Well, out of 2 Samuel 23, verses 13 through 17, we read, then three of the 30 chief men went down and came to David. And David was then in a stronghold. So he's in some type of military encampment here. While the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. And David had a craving and said, now David's going to make a wish here. Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate. So the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines and drew water from the well of Bethlehem, which was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. Nevertheless, he would not drink it, but poured it out to Yahweh. And he said, be it far from me, O Yahweh, that I should do this. Shall I drink the blood of the men who went in jeopardy of their lives? Therefore he would not drink it. Well, question, were there three of these mighty men? Yes. And to do what they did, were they three lucky dudes? They sure were. Well, there just happens to be a constellation, a witness in the sky, by the name of Aquarius, and it pictures a man pouring out water from a jug. And then you can find this in most any star book, like Star Guide, A Field Guide to the Heavens, or Star Names, The Lure and Meaning of Star Names by Richard Allen. And they make statements like this. The constellation pictures a man pouring water from a bucket. And then one of the star names or some of the star, minor stars in Aquarius have these names, which in the Lupin Chin, Oriental name, means the camp with entrenched walls. So there's our stronghold that David was in. And another one means the outpouring of wine. And wine pitcher's blood shall I drink, the blood of these men who went in jeopardy of their lives to get this water, he said. Three principal stars. First one, Sadal Melech. Melech, do we see a Hebrew word there? The Hebrew word for king. And it literally means lucky one of the king. He was a lucky dude, you know. But then there's Sadal Sud, which means the luckiest of the lucky. That dude must have really had a close encounter, you know, and be able to get back with his water. And then the third one, his name means lucky star of hidden things. It's my theory he had to hide a while before he got back with his water. But get this, the last one, Skat, S-K-A-T, meaning wish. David made a wish. And that Sadal Sud, the luckiest of the lucky. In the Oriental language, that means the black warrior. Now, it just so happens that Yahweh names the stars. Psalm 147, verse 4. He doesn't name stars just to be Whistling Dixie. Names have meaning. So I think he's indicating there in an indirect way that one of those guys was a black man. And we know that Uriah the Hittite was a foreigner, so it's not uncommon for foreigners to serve in our military. In fact, we do it right now quite a bit. The two lost kingdoms, Camelot, yes, it's lost, gone. Israel, the northern 10 tribes, lost. But, and what brought them both down? Sin, rebellion. But what is coming? What's on the horizon? Restoration for both of them. Both of us, hallelujah. But what about the name? From David to author, how did that happen? Well, I got to thinking about that one day. I believe Yahweh was prompting me. Roger, author is a title. It's not a name. Do you see AR there? That is sort of like the Hebrew word har, as in Harmageddon or Armageddon. Armageddon, it means high place. And Thur, T-H-U-R, that's the form of the Teutonic word for king, high king. And I thought, okay, that's it. Author is a title. A month later, Yahweh brought this book across my path entitled by Graham Phillips and Martin Keatman, entitled King Arthur, The True Story. They said, yeah, it's not a name, it's a title. Good confirmation. And author does indeed mean a valorous man, a rock, and a bear man. And there's our King David. Yahweh's faithful word, 2 Samuel 7:9, 1 Chronicles 17:8, and I'll make you, David, a great name, like the names of the great men who are on the earth. Well, guess what? He has. Just that most folks haven't figured it out yet. Yahweh is faithful. Now, the big question. Who can connect the dots? Who carried the legend from the land of Israel across Europe to England in at least three migrations, Celtic, Greek, and Scythian? Who? Our forefathers. In their migrations. Many people cannot make that connection. I think it probably has to be divinely opened. So in conclusion, King Arthur, King David, really King Joshua, you know, operating in the form of David in many respects, and David being a picture of Joshua in many respects, our high King of heaven, our victory won. May we reach heaven's joys, Camelot's joys, via our vision, our ruler of all. And what is a vision? It's a person of extraordinary beauty, and there's Joshua, or a thing of extraordinary beauty, and there's Camelot.
Still be my life.
So, the end, well, it just happens to be a P.S. regarding Jack and the Beanstalk. Jack the Giant Killer. Well, let's look at this. You remember the story about Jack? Hey, once upon a time, there was a boy who lived with his mother in a tiny cottage. Very poor. One day, his mother said to him, Jack, you must take our cow to market and sell her so we can buy food. Otherwise, we're going to starve to death. Our very life is tied up in that cow. Well, Jack set out at once. On the way, he met an old man. That's a fine-looking cow, said the old man, the ancient old man. If you'll give her to me, I'll give you some magic beans. Jack stared at the red and yellow beans. How exciting! He took the beans and said goodbye to his cow and hurried home. Jack's mother was very angry, and when she saw what he had done, she said, Silly boy, now we shall starve. And she threw the beans out the window. But the next morning when Jack awoke, his bedroom was dark. He looked out the window through the shade and saw a tremendously tall beanstalk outside. It seemed to reach up to the sky. There those were magic beans, Jack shouted. He jumped out of the window and quickly climbed the beanstalk. At the top, he saw a beautiful castle sparkling in the sun. An old woman greeted him as he hopped off the beanstalk. Don't go near that castle, young man, she said. A wicked giant lives there. Long ago, he stole your father's fortune and left him a poor man. Then I certainly must go get it back, Jack explained, and he strode right up to the castle door. The giant's wife answered the door. If you want food, I'll give you some, she said, but you must hurry. My husband eats boys for breakfast. She gave Jack a slice of bread as big as a tabletop. But even as he ate, there began a great noise outside. Jack leaped into a skillet to hide. There he is, just as the giant entered, bellowing, Fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman. Be he alive or be he dead, I'll grind his bones to make my bread. Well, he bent down, the giant did, and peered under the table. I smell boy. Nonsense, said his wife. Eat your breakfast. Grumbling, the giant sat down to eat 10 roasted oxen and 4 barrels of milk. Drank 4 barrels of milk. And then he shouted, Wife, bring me my magic hen. Well, his wife hurried to obey. Lay, hen, lay. Roared the giant, and the hen laid a golden egg. Very good, said the giant with a mighty yawn, and soon he was sound asleep. At the first snore, Jack popped out of the skillet, snatched up the hen, and ran off. When he had climbed down the beanstalk, his mother grasped at this wonder. With wonder, Jack, she explained, it's your father's magic hen. The next day, Jack climbed the beanstalk again. I'll give you a bite to eat, said the giant's wife when she saw him. But hurry, the giant is in a terrible temper because he lost his magic hen. Well, Jack was eating a tart as big as a fish pond when the castle began to shake. He leaped into a butter churn just as the giant entered, bellowing, Fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman. Be he alive or be he dead, I'll grind his bones to make my bread. Don't tell me you smell boy again, said his wife. Sit down and eat your breakfast. Muttering to himself, the giant gobbled 12 roasted pigs, he was not kosher, and 6 dozen eggs. Then he shouted, Wife, bring me my harp. Quickly, the wife did as she was told. Play, harp, play, commanded the giant, and the harp played such beautiful music that it soon lulled the giant to sleep. At once, Jack jumped out of the butter churn, seized the harp, and ran away. When he reached the bottom of the beanstalk, his mother was waiting. Oh, Jack, she said happily, you have found your father's golden harp. Then, when Jack climbed the beanstalk the next morning, the giant's wife was waiting for him. I'll give you a snack, too, if you wish, she said. But you're in great danger. The giant lost his harp yesterday, and he's in a terrible mood. Well, Jack was eating a cupcake as big as a haystack when he heard the giant coming. He jumped into a pail and listened to the terrible roar. Fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman. Be he alive or be he dead, I'll grind his bones to make my bread. Sit down and eat your breakfast, said the giant's wife. Then you'll feel better. Mumbling angrily, the giant ate 15 roasted ducklings and 200 sausages. I told you he was not kosher. Wife, he growled, fetch my gold. That will cheer me. For a long time, the giant played with his gold pieces. When at last he closed his eyes, Jack jumped out of the pail, snatched the gold, and ran. But the giant had only been pretending to sleep. With a roar, he leaped to his feet. I told you I smell, boy, he bellowed as he raced after Jack. Poor Jack ran faster than he had ever run in his life. Mother, grab the axe, get it ready, he shouted from the top of the beanstalk. As Jack climbed down, the beanstalk began to sway. Jack looked up and saw the giant was coming down, too, right behind him. It was such a frightful sighting that Jack dropped the gold and tumbled all the way to the ground. Quick as a wink, he jumped up and grabbed the axe from his mother. Smack, smack, the beanstalk snapped in two. There was a giant crash, and the giant lay before them dead. Jack's mother gave him a big hug and told him he was indeed a brave boy. You have brought back your father's hen, his harp, and his gold, she said. We shall certainly live happily ever after. For who could be sad with a hen to lay golden eggs, a harp to play beautiful music, and gold to buy bread and cheese, and sometimes strawberry tarts? Okay. Well, it just so happens that another part of the King Arthur legend is that King Arthur had a son. And Graham Anderson talks about that on page 150 of his book. And the son of King Arthur was associated with Jack the Giant Killer, ran with Jack. And Jack gave him the gold, gave this son the gold, which he took from the giant. So with that in mind, King Arthur, King David, had a son named
Solomon,
who ended up with all the gold. Right. 2 Chronicles 1, verse 15, and the king made silver and gold at Jerusalem as plenteous as stones. The gold came from the sky, from heaven. So, Solomon, King Arthur's son, only asked for wisdom. But Yahweh was so impressed, he not only gave him wisdom, but abundant riches and honor and gold that came from heaven, so to speak, from Yahweh. Jack, how about the name? Well, Jack is a contraction of Jacob, and Jackson means Jacob's sons or sons of Jacob. There's our Jack. What about the beans? Magic beans, the lentils of Genesis 25, 27 through 34, with which Jacob or Jack purchased the birthright. The beanstalk, Jack saw the beanstalk leading to the sky after awakening. So, Jacob saw the ladder in a dream after awakening and realized it was the gate to heaven. The castle, the fortified city in heaven. Well, in Deuteronomy 1, verse 28, speaking of the Israelites who had been hesitant about going into the promised land, they were too fearful. Where can we go up? Our brethren have made our hearts melt. You know, the 12 spies. 10 of them at least. The people are bigger and taller than we, and the cities are large and fortified to heaven. There's our castle in heaven. And besides, we saw the sons of the Anakim there, the giants there. Who is the giant's wife in the legend? A woman who betrayed, like a harlot, the giant. So that has to be the woman who assisted Jack, or i.e. his sons, who hid them from the giants, i.e. Rahab the harlot, who hid the two spies, Joshua chapter 2. The giant killer, well, that's the sons of Israel, or Jacob, who conquered the promised land, killed the giants. I love this one. Who is the ancient old man? You give me that cow, your very life, so to speak, and I'll give you these magic beans. You trust me, I'll trust you. Who is it? Out of the 7th chapter of Daniel, verse 9. I kept looking until thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days. took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and his hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames, and its wheels were burning fire. Verse 13, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man. There's Joshua was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days, the ancient old man, so to speak, and was presented before him. Birthright blessings. Yahweh gives magic beans, birthright blessings, to those who exchange, give, or sacrifice their cow, their flesh, their life to him. Same today. Jack's mother, so it will not starve to death. Well, Jack entrusted his very life to the old man. And Yahweh, who created beans, had him to give. Genesis 1, verses 11 and 12. He selected Jacob to receive his magic beans or blessings. Why? Because we Jacobites, we Israelites, have a job, an assignment to do, and Yahweh can trust us to do it. And we have done it down through history to a large extent, being servants of Yahweh, but at the same time, we've had many failures too. And of course, here in America today, we're having many failures as our country is beginning to fall. It all boils down to trust. Jacob placed his trust, faith, and confidence in the old man, the Ancient of Days, and his word. And we're to do the same today. Trust him and his word. Well, what about the hen that laid the golden eggs? Where does that fit in? Well, out of Zechariah 6, verse 19, there's an interesting passage. And the crowns shall be to Helam, and to Tobiah, and to Jediah, and to Hen, the son of Zephaniah, for a memorial in the temple of Yahweh. Well, it just so happens that the word hen, or ken, is the Hebrew word for grace. And are golden eggs unnatural? They sure are, unnatural as can be. And grace from the Almighty is unnatural to the natural man. We read about that in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 24. But a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. And out of 1 Corinthians 2, verse 12, for we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, or Yahweh, that we might know the things freely given to us by Yahweh. And those golden eggs were freely given. And now you know the rest of the story. So, what is the central point of the presentation? Who are our ancestors? Jewish? Probably not. Hebrew, Israelite? Probably. Yeah. Where do we Caucasians come from? From Europe. Where did the Europeans come from? Scythia, Greece and Carthage, and the Celtic migrations. Where did those in turn come from? Right back to Israel, the northern 10 tribes. And what difference does it make knowing this? How did these legends, myths, tales, and bedtime stories come about? I think Yahweh orchestrated them. Man was just thought he was writing some fairy tale, but I think Yahweh was indeed behind it. And I discuss these in more detail in handouts that I have for you. And if any of you listening to the CD would like, send me an email to roger@normanestatelaw.com. roger@normanestatelaw.com. And I'll PDF back to you these handouts that discuss this in more detail. And there are many more connections. I've just eliminated several because of the time limits. So, and as Yahweh gives you more insight into some of these King Arthur and King David connections, well, be sure to let me know and I'll add it to my list. So, well, is it the end? Well, not quite. Because why? What? How? Why is it important that we know these things? Well, as pointed out by the author Stephen M. Collins, who is very proficient and detailed and good at writing about the lost tribes of Israel. He made a comment recently in his blog. If the modern nations of the 10 tribes of Israel, and we're one of them, come to widely recognize their true heritage as the biblical house of Israel, It would revolutionize the self-preconceptions of not only individuals, but of nations as well. It would also verify the Bible, the Holy Bible, as the prophecies about the Israelites' future after the exile from the Promised Land would be seen to be completely accurate and fulfilled. Yahweh's word can be depended upon. So, yes, it's good, important information that we're sharing. But on the other hand, it can do us more harm than good. How? Well, let's suppose that I'm relying upon being a physical Israelite, and that's what's going to ultimately get me into the eternal kingdom. No, we're missing it entirely. And I'm afraid there are many folks today who know about Yahshua, know about these things, but they've never received Yahshua into their life. They've never drank in the water of life. And if we could know all there is to know about that water, but if we never receive it into our being, then it doesn't do us any good. Physical Israel, we are physical Israelites, true, but we need to become spiritual, born-again Israelites by simply giving our life to Yahshua, asking Him into our life, becoming one with Him, united with Him, receiving Him into our lives, drinking that water. And I would encourage any of you listening to this CD today that if you have not done that, you stop right now and go into a private place, bow, and confess that, yes, we are a sinner. Give your life to Yahshua, and He'll come into you. He's knocking at the door, Revelation chapter 3. He wants into your life, but you have to open your door to Him. So, is that the end? Well, yes, the end of my presentation. But for those of you, those of us who have received Yahshua into our life, it's just the beginning as we go through this life walking with Him and into eternity with ages and eons of time to look forward to. And then finally, out of Numbers chapter 6, verses 24 through 27, folks, Yahweh bless us and keep us. Yahweh cause His face to shine upon us, be most gracious to us. Yahweh lift up His wonderful countenance upon us and give us His peace. And according to that passage, I've invoked His name upon us, and He will give us peace. We're blessed. The end.